Sorry, guys. I hit record too early. Looks like you caught me in the middle of my vocal warm-ups. That's pretty embarrassing. It's too bad there's no way I can edit that out. Anyway, I'm Jeremiah, and this is Christian Anarchy.
We begin with concluding remarks. Break up the pieces and examine the parts. Your words always cut when they're cliche. But here's my knife because I came for the buffet. This is the way it goes.
Hey, welcome to the show, or podcast, or presentation, or sermon, or lecture. I'm not really sure what you guys and gals call it, or how you think about it. Before we get to anything else today, if you want to contact me, you can email me at jeremiahjm@gmail.com. If you'd like to follow me on Twitter, where I tweet out some political things, some just plain Jesus things, and some silly things. My Twitter username is @JeremiahJM. And if you want to visit my website, find out other ways to contact me, listen to old episodes, look at resources, you can go to www.christianarchy.net. Well, happy Thanksgiving to y'all. Although I doubt most of you are listening to this on Thanksgiving. In fact, I know you're probably not because I'm recording it on Thanksgiving. So unless you happen to be me and you're listening to the podcast to edit out burps and throat clearings and coughs and pauses to get the cats out of the room. I'm very unprofessional, you guys. And sometimes I even try to edit out the unprofessional stuff. So yeah, unless you're me, you're not listening to this on Thanksgiving, but happy Thanksgiving weekend, I guess, would be an accurate way of saying it. So thank you all. Thanks for listening, for the positive feedback you people keep sending me, for the handful of suggestions and rebuttals I've received, and for being with me today, or at least being with me in spirit, or maybe it's more like I'm with you today. Thanks for letting me be with you today. Also, thanks to all those who have clicked through the Amazon link on the website to make their purchases, and for you people who have donated to the show. I really appreciate it. If you would like to donate to the show, I've made it a little bit easier on the website if you want to visit that. And if you are planning on doing Christmas shopping this holiday season online, which usually means Amazon, you can go to the website and click through my link and I get a teeny tiny percentage of the money Amazon makes off of whatever you order. So if you'd like to help out that way, please do so. As you know, if you're a listener to the podcast, I don't bring this up often. I think I brought it up one other time about 20 episodes ago. So I'll probably plan on keeping that pace pretty similar. If you're an old listener, or you've been listening for a long time rather, your age is irrelevant, you can check out for a minute and think about your errands list or something. If you're a first-time listener, or have only listened to a few episodes, I should tell you this podcast is weird compared to many podcasts. I guess I just did tell you that. Well, one thing that's different is I barely care about entertaining you. I hope you're a little entertained, but what I really want to do is engage your brain and get you thinking. I guess I basically just told you I'm boring, and that wasn't really my intention. The main thing I want to tell you that's different about this podcast than many others is that it's often difficult to just pick a random episode and listen to it. While I haven't exactly done it in linear fashion, I have been building on episodes from the beginning. Some of them are self-contained, but many are part of an extensive development of philosophy and theology. Naturally, as the creator of the podcast, I recommend you go back and start at episode 1 and listen to all of it. The most essential episodes are probably number 1 and number 2, to get a background of both what anarchy is and some of the theological foundations for it. Someday, I might create a separate grouping of 7 or so episodes of the ones I think are most essential. But I didn't do that today, and I probably won't do it tomorrow either. So, although I recommend you start from the beginning, if you happen to be starting on this episode, well, you're in some luck, as today will be a little bit of a review day. I will also go back to the basics to explain what anarchy is as a political philosophy, in addition to the theological points I will go over. After 24 previous episodes, I'm at the point where I've produced enough content that reviewing it might be helpful, and I think this will be a good episode to do it in. Last week, I showed how the Bible makes some pretty strong arguments in support of slavery and polygamy, and gave some of the reasons and ways we can use the Bible to reject those things in modern times as being less than God's ideal. I hope the purpose behind this was apparent, but if not, the purpose will become very clear today. Today, I'm going to talk about something very disappointing about the scriptures as they pertain to anarchy. They don't quite say everything I would like them to, as clearly as I would like them to. I haven't been hiding this from you or delaying telling you, just waiting for the right moment to let you know about this tragic omission. The Bible never says, if you're a follower of Jesus, you must also be an anarchist. Or all governments are illegitimate. Or government is evil. Or God's ideal for humanity is for them to be without human rulers. Or really anything completely conclusive about the wrongness of governments. In fact, while one can make some pretty strong arguments against governments using scripture, it is also possible to use scripture to make some strong arguments in support of governments. This is why I felt doing last week's episode was important. I wanted to show that there are many things we assume are wrong based upon scripture and what we learn from it, even though it's possible to make a biblical argument in support of those things. It is possible to take the same stance with government as with slavery, where we can acknowledge there are some biblical arguments for government, but we still think it is an inherently unethical system. As a review, what is anarchy? Anarchy is a word which comes from the Greek and is made up of two separate parts. The first part is an, meaning without, and the second part is arche, coming from the word archos, which means ruler. So anarchy means without rulers. It's a simple idea that says one man should not rule over another. The more extensive anarchy philosophy has two interconnected ideas which form the basic foundation. The first is the non-aggression principle, or the NAP, and this is a principle that helps guide interpersonal ethics. And this says that it's wrong to aggress against your fellow human being using force, theft, or fraud. Some definitions, instead of aggress, talk about initiating coercion, but they mean basically the same thing. The NAP outlines the type of morality you learn as children. Don't hit other people, don't steal from them, and if you say you're going to do something, then do it. It's not that hard, it's not that objectionable. So anarchists take this idea and apply it universally. Anarchy also contains another concept which helps form the foundation for the philosophy of anarchy, is the idea of self-ownership. This is one of those things most people deem to be self-evident. It's simply the idea that every individual owns themselves. They have rightful jurisdiction over their body and over their mind, and because of these things, they also have rightful jurisdiction over their actions and over their creations, over their choices, their morals, the product of their labor, and their rightfully acquired property. And this doesn't exclude the idea that people came from God and should be grateful to God for their existence and for what they have. It just means that God has chosen to give them authority over their own life. It's the nature of the reality that He created. The idea of self-ownership helps us exclude the idea that other people should own someone else, that an individual can be owned by another person. So that's the basic ideas of anarchy. Again, I find them pretty self-evident, simple, and moral. Government is a group of people who use violence and the threat of violence to impose their will upon others. When an anarchist analyzes government, they see that the government exists through the violation of the non-aggression principle. And the easiest way to talk about this, even though I've talked about it many times before, I'll talk about it again, is to think about taxation, where for the government to do anything, they need money to pay the people to help them to do things. And they acquire that money by saying, people, give us X dollars because of the land you own, or because of the product you bought, or because of the work you did. So what government does is tell self-owned people that they must give them the product of their labor, which they own. So not only does the government violate the non-aggression principle, so in that way the government claims ownership over those people by claiming ownership over what they produced with their body and the money they made from that production. If they don't give them those taxes, then the government will find a way to take the money from them anyway and lock them in a cage. But if they resist having their money taken from them and resist being locked in a cage, the government will kill them. If they choose to exercise self-defense over their body and their property, they'll be murdered by the state. So just with that simple example, we see that the government exists through theft and exists through exercising ownership over others. So the anarchist looks at government and says, well, if you shouldn't initiate coercion on someone else using physical force, theft, or fraud, and people own themselves, then the government's existence, the foundation for their existence, is the money they acquire, and so their existence is inherently immoral. And then the anarchist rejects it. It's about applying principles of basic human ethics, don't hit, don't steal, universally, and not making special exceptions for one organization simply because there's a lot of people who have made exceptions for it in the past. Another simple way to talk about anarchy is this: all human relationships should be voluntary. This means no individual or group of individuals has a right to use coercion on another. Anarchy is about saying, let's not hurt each other, take each other's stuff, or use one another by failing to follow through on our formal agreements. Anyone who agrees to that and chooses to apply it consistently is an anarchist. While we have a special label for it now, I would just call it being a decent human being. In case you needed a review, that's a simple explanation of anarchy. The scriptures do not explicitly teach anarchy as the form of organizing society followers of Jesus should pursue. But when we look at the many themes in scripture, the nature of reality the scripture teaches, and the principles God gives us to live by, one can make a very strong case that the ideal way to organize society is without instituting violent and coercive rulers. Last week, I gave many scriptures to support slavery and polygamy, and then explained why we reject those arguments and embrace arguments which assume both of those things are wrong. Today, I'm not going to give you biblical arguments which justify government. Although I think I can make a pretty strong case for the other side, I don't really want to help people support the state. I'm only going to go over arguments I've already made, which provide reasons to reject the state. If you've forgotten about these arguments or have never heard them and want to hear a more extensive version of them, go to the website again. That's www.christianarchy.net. Type in the number 25, just 25, into the search bar, and that will take you to the episode page in the show notes page for this episode, episode 25, and I will list some of the arguments and the episodes they came from in the notes. The first biblical argument I made came from a discussion about the way God made the world. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth and the plants and the animals and the seas and the land and the stars and the moon and the light and the dark. Lots of other things. I probably shouldn't keep listing them. But in this, he also created humans. And when he did this, he talked about a hierarchy of creation. Humans were given dominion over the animals and the plants and the earth and told to subdue it and fill it and take care of it, rule over it. And then, in the next story, God creates Eve, and Eve was made to be Adam's partner, his equal and opposite, like all the animals had, someone to work alongside him and with him and complement him and be his helper, which we talked about is also a word used of God, so it doesn't connote or denote any sort of hierarchy relationship. It's just a part of what her role was, and his role was to help her. But then in the garden, Adam and Eve came across the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And this was the only thing God told them not to do. Don't eat of this tree or you will die. And at the tree was a serpent, and the serpent convinced the man and the woman to eat of the fruit of the tree. The whole world changed. Death came into it. And there were lots of curses associated with this. One was that man had to work harder for his food. And another was that woman would have pain in childbearing. And another curse that happened when sin came into the world is that man ruled over his wife. God said to Eve, "Your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you." And when we look at the context of Genesis 3, we see that that is not God's ideal for creation, but a part of where the whole process went awry. People ruling over other people happened because of sin, not because of the way that God made the world. Because as we saw in the beginning of Genesis, when God creates a hierarchy of creation, he never puts one person over another person. It's people together over the rest of creation. And then a little while longer after the first sin, the Bible shows a progression of sin in the world. It's like a snowball that starts growing as it rolls down the hill, building and expanding, and every new sin compounding on one another until the small snowball becomes, is there a word for a really large snowball? It becomes a really big snowball. If there's a better word for that, I wish I knew it. But anyway, the point is sin keeps growing. We have their children Cain and Abel, and we see Cain not respecting the self-ownership of Abel, and in his jealousy, he murders him. And then a little bit later, a few generations later, a man named Lamech comes, and Lamech shows himself to be like Cain. He's a worse version of Cain. He's more vengeful, more aggressive, more violent, brings more death, and he took multiple women to be his wives. Later on, we see more people called the sons of the gods, which, as I talked about, I think the best interpretation of has them being local despots. Some people talk about them being angels, or fallen angels, rather, who come down to earth and have sex with women. But I think that in the context of the story from Cain and Abel to the flood, what makes the most sense of the most amount of data is to think about them as being local, powerful rulers who, like many kings, attribute their authority and their power to being divine in some manner. So we have these local sons of the gods who are men like Lamech in that they take any women they want and they brutalize people, in that their rule and their power and their violence is so strong that they take any woman they want. They completely violate the self-ownership of these women and kill anyone who tries to prevent them from taking them. And then the Bible talks about how this violence, the earth was full of violence. And because of all these people and all these relationships of rule, where people were violently and coercively aggressing against other people, ruling over other people, something that God never wanted to be in the world in the first place, because it was so prevalent, God sent the flood. Later on in the story, I talked about Israel going into slavery and how they were under Pharaoh, who was such an oppressive government authority. He would have their kids killed if they weren't the right gender. He made them work without pay to do his bidding. He was the government ruler who exercised almost complete control over their body, over their time, and over their relationships. But God did not want his people to be under such oppression. He wanted them to be free, free to rest, free to worship God without being under this heavy hand, free to work for themselves and acquire the benefit of their own labor. It is not God's desire for humanity for them to be owned by other people. And I would argue, not only is it not God's desire for people to be completely owned by other people, but it's not God's desire for people to be partially owned by other people, which is what smaller governments are. Large governments own almost completely, and smaller governments just own in part. And then even further on in the story, we have one of the judges, from Judges 9, I believe, a guy named Gideon, and he was a hero who saved Israel from their oppression from, I think it was the Midianites or Philistines, but some sort of ancient Near Eastern small tribe mentioned in the Bible that I can't always keep track of, and I don't have my Bible open. Maybe it was the Moabites. Sorry for not knowing, but you guys can trust me that it was someone. And Gideon participated with God to rescue them from foreign ruler coming in and taking over them. And then the people, because he was such a hero, asked him to reign over them. And Gideon said, "No, I will never rule over you, and I will never put my son in place to rule over you, because God is your rightful ruler." But then, instead of following in his father's example, Gideon's son Abimelech chose to be a really naughty boy. And what he did is get a group of people together who wanted to institute him as ruler. And then he killed all of his brothers. I believe it was like 70 of them. But he was unable to find and kill one of his brothers named Jotham. And then Jotham, Gideon's only other surviving son, gets up and tells a parable which shows Jotham to be a lot like his dad. And in this parable, Jotham talks about the trees who are looking for a ruler. And the trees go up to the vine branch and the fig tree and the olive tree. And on all the occasions, they ask these trees to be their ruler. And these trees say, "No, I'm honoring God through the grapes I produce and the figs I produce and the olives I produce. I'm already giving something good to humanity and bringing God glory by my productivity. And I'm able to be blessed by growing things and bless others through what I grow. So I have no need or desire to rule over you, you group of trees." And then the trees go to the bramble. And the bramble is this thorny bush that's really just good for poking things and taking up the nutrients of the soil and the sunlight that the other productive plants would otherwise use. And the bramble is what chose to rule. This story, this parable, is about the nature of the type of people who choose power. More often than not, the people who choose power are the pokey people, the violent people, the coercive people, the ones who can't produce anything good themselves, the ones who aren't already bringing something good into the world, seek to add meaning or joy or some sort of purpose to their life by exercising violent authority over others. And I asked the question, or at least I made a statement that was questioning, about whether it was that people who sought power were like this, or that the acquisition of power made people like this. And we kind of get to a conclusion later on in Israel's history. Israel wanted to have a king in order to be like the other nations, which is not out of character for Israel. They were given to trying to be like the other nations in a lot of ways through their dress and their clothing, which are the same thing as I'm saying it right now, and their idols and their practices. They often were guilty of becoming way too much like the other nations and not being distinct the way God wanted them to be distinct. One of the ways God wanted them to be distinct was to have himself and only himself as their king. So when they requested Samuel the prophet give them a king, they were actually rejecting God as their king. And God comes out and says this explicitly. So God didn't want Israel to have a king ever other than himself, because he wanted them to be set apart and holy and to follow him, not him in addition to another man, which is what idolatry is. You can only have one king at a time, and they chose a human king instead of God. And God also warned them about having a king, saying that having a king would lead to more wars, and having a king would lead to their sons and their daughters taken as servants, and the people who are most skilled being taken by the king to serve in his court, and multiple people being taken as his wives. And he told them that they would be taxed by this king, and he talked about that tax as being equivalent to being enslaved. or at least paralleling being enslaved. And this is in 1 Samuel 8 primarily. But if you read a little further, they talk more about the aftermath of God instituting a king. But still, even though God wanted to be their king and didn't want them to have another human king and warned them about the negative effects of having a king, he chose to accommodate them and he instituted a king over them anyway. He was willing to meet them where they're at and even accept their rejection of him so that he could continue in relationship with them and take them from where they are to someplace better through intimacy. And you're going to be shocked by this, but God's warnings about these kings turned out to be quite true. All of them did horrible things. They used their position of power to destroy. But it wasn't just the bad kings that did this. There's lots of kings that were bad kings. But there's also one king in particular named David, who was considered to be the best king of Israel's history. He's the king to which all other kings are compared. And David becomes a murderer. He has many wives, and despite having many wives, he commits adultery with a woman of one of his troops who was away fighting his war for him. So David takes the wife of someone fighting his war for him, even though he already has multiple wives. And she gets pregnant, but David doesn't want people to know about it. So David has the man fighting for him killed and takes the wife anyway. This is exactly what the sons of the gods did back in Genesis 6 before the flood. They took whatever women they wanted to be their wives, and their fathers or any men in their lives were unable to prevent them from being taken because they had so much power over other people. And their evil was so great, God sent the flood. And David, Israel's best king, Israel's moral example for what a good king should be like, did the very same thing. So we see, it's not just that bad people take power. It's also that once they acquire power, even people like David, who used to be a shepherd and productive in many ways, often are corrupted by that power. And the reason is, I would argue, is that people were never created to have that sort of power over another person. We were never made to be in these relationships of coercion where we are using violence and the threat of violence to impose our will upon others. And the more people get in those positions and choose to use that violence, choose to use that force, the more they become subhuman. I guess the less human they become, the less like God they become, the more degraded the image of God in them becomes. Quite simply, becoming less human is becoming more evil. Then we go to the New Testament, a mix of the Old and the New Testament, where we see stories where Satan seems to be the one running things when it comes to these earthly nations and these earthly powers, where even Jesus seems to implicitly acknowledge that Satan has the power and the right and the authority to give him all of the kingdoms of the earth, which makes complete sense given what we know about these kingdoms of the earth, because we know the two primary tools in Satan's toolbox are death and deception. And what we see from nations, at least in my lifetime in the U.S., there is a lot of death, and everything the government does relies on the threat of death. The deception never ceases. How many honest politicians are there? I don't know if there are any, and there are some that are much more honest than others. Don't get me wrong. But every politician lies. Every politician says something they don't mean, and every politician makes promises they don't keep. They're renowned for it, so much so that I don't know if there's anyone over 25 that says, yeah, I would expect that politicians would follow through on their promises once they get elected. Death and deception are the primary tools of government in modern times, and I suspect in past times. Where we see Satan working, we should expect those two things to be present as well. So when we look at that, when we see that Satan has authority over these kingdoms, it's weird for us, and I would argue contrary to us, to actively participate in trying to give these kingdoms more power. When we give these governments more power, I believe we give one of the primary tools of our enemy more power to inflict his damage in the world. And I'd rather not do that. But we also have a different story where Jesus comes to earth and he sets up his kingdom in the midst of his people, in the midst of these other governments. There are groups of people, pockets of followers of Jesus who have their own kingdom, where things are done a lot different than the kingdoms of the earth. They're loving and peaceful and voluntary, and they follow Jesus rather than their earthly rulers, because you can't follow two masters. And when Jesus talks to his followers about this kingdom and how it is different than the kingdoms of the world, he tells them to avoid being like the governments of the world, who lord their position and exercise authority. Instead, what Jesus asks of people in his kingdom is to, even when they have a position of influence, to serve and treat everyone as an equal, as your brother, as your friend, as someone who you would never place underneath you. And with this kingdom of oneness and unity and family and brotherly and sisterly relationships, instead of hierarchical relationships, it seems like it would be unfitting for a follower of Jesus to participate in the government where relationships are not only hierarchical, but violent and deadly. It exists in complete contradiction to the way of the kingdom of heaven. So that's a brief run-through of many of the arguments I have made. I hope that made sense. It's hard for me to try to run through the details of everything without going back and looking at what I said before, but that's a lot of the major arguments I've made thus far. So as long as we're talking a little bit about Jesus now, I'm going to make one new-ish argument today that I've touched on before, but more specifics might help. I think it's pretty simple. This argument requires we talk about some of the principles Jesus gives us in some passages in the book of Matthew. The first one is Matthew 7, verses 12. It says, or Jesus says in this text, "So whatever you wish that others would do to you, do also to them, for this is the law and the prophets." Simple. Treat others the way you want to be treated. Act toward them the way you would like them to act toward you. And this is the law and the prophets, which is a crazy long and complex thing to summarize. But Jesus is saying, essentially, if you want to follow the heart of the law of Moses and be a representative of the people of God in the way that they are idealized in the prophets, there is one simple way to do it. Think about what you want people to do to you, then do it to them. Implicit in this simple principle is also the version of it which uses negations. Don't do to others what you wish they wouldn't do to you. Obviously, if you do something to others you wouldn't want them to do to you, then you aren't following the principle Jesus gives. Jesus says something similar and more complete in Matthew 22, verses 37 through 40. The text says, "And he said to him, 'You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your mind. This is the first and greatest commandment. And the second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments depend all the law and the prophets.'" This verse is a little more expansive because it includes more about specifically loving God and not just loving people. It contains a very similar exhortation about loving people as Matthew 7:12 does. Do to others as you would have them do to you, and love your neighbor as yourself. Show as much compassion and consideration for your fellow human being as you show for yourself. You meet your own needs, meet your neighbor's. You give yourself the benefit of the doubt, give them the benefit of the doubt as well. You try to prevent negative things from happening in your life, help your neighbor avoid those too. You don't want people mistreating you, so don't mistreat your neighbor and try to help them when someone else is mistreating them. A part of loving people is not only treating them well, but avoiding treating them poorly. Now consider some of the ways you wouldn't want me to treat you, ways you wouldn't want me to act upon you. Would you want me to ignore you or hit you, talk about you badly behind your back, steal from you, hurt your friends, refuse to follow through on our agreements? I'm guessing the answer to all those questions is probably no, except for maybe the one about ignoring you. I can get quite annoying if I'm not ignoring people, at least on occasion. There are a lot of standards we all agree on when it comes to loving one another. Do be generous. Don't steal. Do give your time. Don't avoid them. Do treat them with respect. Don't hit them. Do follow through on what you said you were going to do with them or for them. Don't be unreliable. I'm sure we can find some places we disagree on what love looks like toward others. But these are just some of the very basic implications we probably all see eye to eye on. These things are about how we treat people directly. But how we treat others is not only about how we act upon them personally, but about how we act on them indirectly through what we support. It's also about how we treat others through a third party. If you shouldn't hit someone, then you also shouldn't hire someone to hit them. If you shouldn't steal from someone, you shouldn't ask someone else to steal from them for you. If you shouldn't threaten someone with death in order to have them behave the way you want them to, then you shouldn't convince someone else to threaten them with death to behave the way you want them to either. Again, pretty basic stuff, and I think pretty difficult to disagree with. The Christian anarchist takes the principles of treating others the way you'd like to be treated and loving your neighbor as yourself and applies them to government. Government pays for everything they do with theft. Governments frequently hurt people around the world for their own perceived gain. Governments command people who are within reach of their power, obey my orders about your body, your life, your property, your labor, and your relationships, or else I'll kill you. The Christian anarchist believes theft, violence, and death threats are not a loving way to treat another human being. So they reject any system which relies on these things as something they can support and maintain their integrity. It's not all that complicated. Having spent a few years thinking this way and developing my thought as an anarchist, it feels obvious. Still, despite all these arguments I have made, there are still more I've yet to make, although I think I've touched on most of the strongest biblical arguments. I have not definitively proven Christians should be anarchist, and I never will be able to. You will always be able to make a decent biblical argument in support of government, in the same way that I can make a decent biblical argument in support of slavery. The only way a Christian can apply the basic principles Jesus gives us and justify slavery is by saying the system of slavery is a special exception, and those basic principles don't apply to people in that arena. When we see government for what it is, and we apply basic, Jesus-given ethics to the government, we see government violates these principles we are supposed to live by. So here are our choices. Either we make a special exemption for the government system, the same exemption people made for slavery, where we say, as long as we are acting indirectly through the system of government, we don't really have to love our neighbor. Or we don't make any such special exemption, and we apply our principles universally, across the board, to every system and every relationship we have, whether direct or indirect. I propose we do the latter. It's such a destructive system, and the way that they function runs so contrary to the kingdom of God. Violence is the government's primary tool. Violence is the essence of all government power. It's the government's sickle, and its harvest is people made in God's image, The whole system survives by feeding on people through the threat of death if they do not consent to being consumed. Peacemakers cannot see such a system for what it is and accept its legitimacy any more than a human rights activist can see slavery for what it is and accept the legitimacy of that system. It's kind of crazy. I've been talking about these ideas for years, and no one has ever explained how government acts without using violence and the threat of violence on peaceful people. I've claimed they do, and people rarely even make an attempt to refute the point. I would love for someone to actually refute me on this essential notion that all government requires the initiation of force on others, but they never do. I'm continually amazed by this. It's such a simple position and such an ethically obvious one. Rather than argue government doesn't need to use violence on nonviolent people to exist, and to point out how it could do so, people merely seek to justify government's violence against people who are simply following their own conscience and interacting with others voluntarily without violating their rights. They don't disagree that the violence exists. They simply jump into rationalizing their aggressive violence. I've dealt with many attempts to justify this violence. Things like, if you don't like it, you can leave. Or the idea that democracy, that formalizing mob rule, somehow makes mob rule just and right. Or that government is necessary. And just trying to counteract this idea that because government has done something, they must always do it, and it cannot be done otherwise. It's really about a lack of imagination and a lack of courage. And there are other arguments out there that I've dealt with and others I haven't, and some express legitimate concerns, but I think all of them are way too weak and insubstantial to justify the incessant and widespread violence of the state. While I cannot prove all Christians should be anarchists, I think I've made a pretty cut and dried case that it is impossible to be a peaceful human being while arguing for the existence of government. If you want to support the existence of government, you must support the use of violence against your fellow human being, your brothers and your sisters in Christ. While it is possible to reject government and still be a violent person, it is impossible to support the existence of government without being one. I don't think followers of Jesus should be violent people. At the very least, they shouldn't be people who initiate violence on others. You cannot hide behind a government and pretend you're innocent. Meaning, just because you don't actively participate in the violence yourself does not absolve you of responsibility for their actions when you're supporting them. Because coercion is the foundation of all government action, one not need hold a gun to someone else's head to use the threat of violence against them. They need only to support the person holding the gun. They need only ask someone to hold it for them, or vote for them, or validate the system that allows them to use such force without repercussions. You cannot support a system founded on violence without sharing the guilt of the violence they do. To argue for government is to argue for aggressive violence. You cannot do this without yourself being a violent person. And I understand this is a strong statement which might offend people. As I'm sure you're well aware of by now, not offending people is not my primary concern. I'm concerned with truth. Is what I'm saying true or is it false? That is my primary concern. If it is false, then I need you to tell me why, because I am very misguided if it is. And please explain what is false. Is it my interpretation of biblical principles? My assumptions? My reasoning? Come on, people. If I'm completely off on my central proposition, then I need my brothers and sisters to correct me. Please take the time to do so. That's all. This thing gets all too serious sometimes. Jeez, chill out, Jeremiah. All right, I will. Thank you for joining me today. Love you guys. Peace and joy.
Still find my way into the dark.